of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Dozier pops it up, foul ground, Middlebrooks dives to make the catch. That is strike three, and a nice start tonight for John Lester. Fly ball to left field. Back goes Domet. He is onto the warning track. It's off the wall. Red Sox will win.
Simple, universal, playable. The ball is among the most recognizable artifacts of human culture. It also drives an estimated $500 billion a year sports industry and a fervor that includes Red Sox Nation. Harvard anthropologist John Fox set off on a global adventure and dug into the ancient past to uncover the origins and evolution of our favorite ball games. The result is a book called The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. It's now out in paperback. We spoke to John when the book was first published. John told me that his fascination with the ball began with tossing one around.
Yes, you know, it started as an innocent game of backyard catch with my 7-year-old son, and in the middle of playing, he stopped and he had this funny look in his face and he said, "Hey, Dad, why do we play ball anyway?" And it was one of those existential questions, you know, only a 7-year-old can really ask. And when I thought about it, I didn't have an easy answer. I couldn't tell him where all these games came from, and I couldn't tell him why it mattered so much to us. So off I went on a journey.
Right. So you began your research into the ball, not with humans, however, but animals, dolphins and bonobos. Why?
I think anybody who's ever played catch with their dog knows that humans didn't invent the idea of play. Clearly, this idea of play was something much deeper, much more fundamental than humans. So I decided to go deep into kind of the origins of play in the animal kingdom and in the brain itself.
What makes play so important to the development of humans and the human brain?
Well, a few things. First of all, play is a way that we engage the world as young children. One of the fundamental stages of childhood development is the ability to roll a ball back and forth with another kid. So it's a physical capability. It's also your cognitive development. It's also a social thing. I mean, we play with other people. It's a form of collaboration, cooperation. It's a way we get to know how to relate to other people. So it has so many dimensions, and it's important on so many levels.
And a big part of your exploration is about the physical object itself. You know, why the ball and not the cube or the pyramid, which could also be tossed around?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of a pyramid thrown my way. The ball is a fascinating object. First of all, it's, you know, we live on a ball. We live on a sphere. It's kind of an elemental form. But it's also, you know, I think of it as a kinetically interesting object. And by that, I mean, you know, there's no other object that can spin and ricochet and bounce. You know, think of a knuckleball pitcher and what he can do to a ball. There's really no other physical object like that in nature. So it's no wonder that it fascinated us for so long.
But you found in a lot of odd objects that have been used as balls or what they've been made of through the ages. Can you give us a sample?
Well, you know, funny enough, the first mention of the game of tennis is from a 13th century document that talks about a monk who lost a bargain with the devil, basically, and he goes to hell and he gets knocked back and forth by demons, becomes the ball himself. But I don't think that was the typical form of play.
It's a very grim picture of the fiery furnaces of hell. But there's more on the origins of tennis in the book. It actually did become what you call the game of priests before it became the game of kings.
Yeah, so tennis originated in France around the 13th century. And it was played in the monasteries, in the cloisters, by monks who were probably bored between prayers and penance. It was played with the hand. There was no net. It was called jeu de paume, the game of the hand. And then the young princes and royalty were being educated in the monasteries, so they took it up, and it became hugely popular, all the rage on the royal circuit. And to this day, I think it remains a kind of perception, at least, of being kind of an elite sport.
But we get a kind of contrast of that and the origins of American football and soccer. Tell us a little bit about that and how, you know, the difference in these two sports reflect the cultures and the atmospheres that gave rise to them.
One of the things that I found fascinating was how the way games originated centuries back still affects the way they're played today. So as I said, tennis has this kind of elite aristocratic origin. On the contrary, soccer, or really every game of football, began as this people's sport. In the same medieval period in England, games of football were played, only they were played by literally everyone in the village, one village against another, hundreds of people in these massive scrums that were played on special feast days. They were kind of festive communal rites, and they were raucous affairs. In fact, in the 14th century alone, English monarchs banned the game 9 times because they did so much destruction to property. And so it became, over time, it kind of remained this people's game. And it's no wonder that it's a global game that, you know, the last World Cup was watched by 3.2 billion people, half the planet.
It is the sweeping popularity of these games that's so interesting. In fact, you write in Mesoamerica, a game often called the world's very first ball game played by the Aztecs with very, very high stakes. This game of ulama, is that how you say it?
That's right.
Can you
yes.
describe it to us?
Ulama was played as early as 1500 BC. It was played in an alleyway with sloping walls and these big hoops, kind of like basketball rings, only tilted sideways. And the players would strike the ball with their hip. And the most fascinating thing is that the ball itself was made of this substance that the rest of the world didn't know for millennium later, which is called rubber. So they invented rubber, and they put it to good use. The thing that is a little grisly and dark about the game is that in at least some of them, the loser was ritually sacrificed. It kind of adds a new meaning to the idea of sudden death.
Okay, so we look at the evolution from there to what we're looking at now in sports. I have a dear friend who always says, you know, the sports pages are he reads it first because it's the only place where there's resolution in the newspaper. Not so much anymore. You know, the stories are unresolved. Battles over money and doping scandals and injuries and bribes. How has play and sports changed over the years? I mean, you're looking at a very long arc, obviously.
It's changed for sure. I mean, it's been incremental. I mean, you know, sports has always had gambling and there's been corruption in the past. But I think we've reached kind of new heights or new lows, as they might say. It's become obviously a huge business, a $500 billion global business, as you said. And that raises the stakes in general. And I think, you know, you see it with steroid use. You see it even with youth sports. And I think what's lost is something about the essence of the games themselves and why they matter and the very idea of play.
Is that what you think you discovered? Is that the object of the game that you went on this quest for?
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of like Nike says, just do it.
Well, John Fox, I really want to thank you for doing it because you did it all over the world, and it's a terrifically enthralling read. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
John Fox, an anthropologist. He's written for the Smithsonian, Outside Magazine, and Salon, among others. He's also a regular contributor for our pals over at Vermont Public Radio and the author of The Ball, Discovering the Object of the Game. You'll find links to more on the book and to reviews at wordofmouthradio.org.